Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Production assistance today from Harriet Williamson and Henry Frayne is at the controls. One of the biggest questions these days is, will the United States start a war in Iraq to remove Saddam Hussein? The New York Times has already reported on extensive preparations and even battle plans for war in Iraq, while President Bush says he hasn't yet made up his mind. Members of Congress have weighed in, and it seems that Republican leaders have more reservations about it than the Democrats this time around. Now seems like an important moment to ask a number of questions about the proposition of war with Iraq. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about some of those questions with Colonel David Hackworth, a war correspondent, commentator, and veteran in every sense of the word. His military career as a sailor, soldier, and military correspondent has spanned nearly a dozen wars and conflicts, from the end of World War II to the war in former Yugoslavia. He enlisted in the Merchant Marine at age 14 and the U.S. Army at 15. And during almost 26 years in the Army, he spent over 7 years in combat theaters, winning a battlefield commission in Korea to become that war's youngest Army captain. In 1971, he was the Army's youngest colonel in Vietnam when he spoke out on national television saying, "This is a bad war. It can't be won, and we need to get out." The recipient of many honors, Colonel Hackworth still considers the Combat Infantry Badge and the United Nations Medal for Peace, which he was presented for his anti-nuclear work in Australia, his highest awards. Colonel Hackworth is also a regular guest on national radio and television shows, and from 1990 to the end of 96, he was Newsweek's contributing editor for defense, and along with Newsweek cover stories and other reporting, he has been featured in magazines including People, Parade, Men's Journal, and has also been published in Playboy, Soldier of Fortune, Self, and Modern Maturity. His column, Defending America, appears weekly in newspapers across the country and on his website, www.hackworth.com. And his books include The Vietnam Primer, the international bestseller About Face, Hazardous Duty, and The Price of Honor. And his new book is entitled Steal My Soldier's Heart, and that's now in bookstores. And Colonel David Hackworth joins us by telephone this morning. As we talk with David Hackworth, your questions are welcome as well on the topic. That is, we try to stick to the subject at hand here and ask people to try to be brief so we can include as many people as possible. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Colonel Hackworth, good morning.
Reporting for duty, Jack.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us again.
My pleasure.
Appreciate your time. I wanted to start by sort of observing, you reported from the front lines of the 1991 Gulf War extensively. We're now seeing a sort of a national debate on military action to perhaps finish what the Gulf War started. I'm very interested in your take on this. Is war with Iraq in the best interests of the American people? What might it accomplish, and what are the potential repercussions?
Well, that's really a political question. And where I am from is the military, and I can tell you a lot about bayonets and gunpowder, but not a lot about political stuff.
Sure.
I'll give you citizen Hackworth's view, nothing to do with soldier Hackworth's view. And that is, the president hasn't made a case. He needs to make a case exactly as John Fitzgerald Kennedy made in October of 1962, during the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, when he went on to TV and showed satellite imagery, photographs, of this is a Soviet missile, this is a Soviet launcher,
right.
These are Soviet soldiers. They're 90 miles from our shore in Cuba, and they could devastate the United States. And the American people said, Jack, take them out. Now, we haven't had this kind of argument. And we haven't had this kind of presentation. We have a lot of folks running around that are in the employment of President Bush who are saying we need to do it. But none of them, to me, have given me a very strong, and citizen Hackworth, reason for it. Now, soldier Hackworth will tell you that Saddam Hussein is a bad guy. But do we go to war with people that are bad guys, because right now we're filling the wallets of a lot of bad guys in just one country alone. In Afghanistan, with warlords, we're filling their wallets with American bucks to buy their allegiance to us, and they're not good people. We're doing the same in the Philippines. I could probably trip right through the world and identify the kind of folks we're supporting. And we got into this mess when we were supporting Saddam Hussein, because he was taking on Iran back for eight long, bloody, bloody years. Over a million people went down in that war in the 80s. So, yes, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological. Yes, he's probably, from all intelligence I get coming my way, he's probably putting together a nuke weapon, probably doesn't have it now. But it just doesn't seem to me that the president's made a case in any way.
Well, as Soldier Hackworth, I mean, doesn't it seem strange that we're sort of, I mean, we're getting the clear idea that there are many people within the administration, within the Defense Department, that really want to pursue this and take war to Iraq and remove Saddam Hussein, and yet the president continues to say, I haven't made up my mind. I mean, this is not a very clear-cut sort of articulation of policy.
Well, my experience at looking at the Pentagon, either as a reporter or working for them as a soldier for the last 57 years, which is a few years, Jack,
right.
I seldom see when the Defense Department didn't want to go to war because, hey, that's good for business. And I think that the president has been just terrible in terms of articulating specific goals. And now he's hiding down on the farm doing mumbo-jumbo and not really standing tall and telling the American people the truth. Now, if there's something that he has that I don't know, and I talk to about 500 warriors a day that are spread around the globe, in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and a lot of other people in the intelligence community, and I got to tell you that I haven't seen sufficient evidence. All I have seen is circumstantial stuff. And I don't think that if you went to court and laid your evidence, if you were Bush, that he so far displayed to the American people, to a courtroom, the guilty, the accused would walk, man.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, we have a caller to talk with, but I will include them in a minute, but I just wanted to ask one more question.
Yes, sir.
We've heard from several former weapons inspectors, among them Scott Ritter, and there's a few others that are out, you know, speaking on the subject, and they seem to be at odds over whether or not Iraq possesses or is rebuilding weapons of mass destruction. Do we really know?
There have been a great amount of intelligence information that's come out of Iraq that says that they are building weapons of mass destruction, including nukes. Now, is this tainted evidence? Are these people, many of them are defectors, they're on the run from the Iraqi government, are they telling us what we want to know? And now, Scott Ritter, he is a guy that was out there, and he says, no, they're not doing it. And the thing about Scott Ritter is he's very qualified to make that comment. He was an inspector out there. But he's one, Jack, of many, many inspectors, and many inspectors disagree with him. So he wasn't like, Scott Ritter is not the god of all weapons of mass destruction items. He is just one guy. His boss, who's a personal friend of mine, Richard Butler, who is a very good man, and I met him when I led the anti-nuclear movement in Australia, and you know what his job was? Ambassador for Peace. Mm-hmm. Australia was the first country in the world to appoint an ambassador for peace.
Right.
And so he's not a warmonger. He's not somebody that says, let's go get him. But Richard Butler says they're doing it. So I don't know what to believe. And what I've learned about this whole trip of reporting and all of that is if I haven't seen it and I can't smell it and I don't feel it, then I don't believe it.
Well, very good. But we have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We have a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning.
Hi there. I was just wondering, somehow all the news reports seem to be linking this war cry against Iraq to the 9/11 stuff, you know, the war on terrorism. And I wondered if you had heard of any evidence whatsoever which links Iraq with Al-Qaeda or anybody that seems to be involved with the incidences of 9/11. And I will get off the air to listen.
Thanks for the question.
The answer is only circumstantial. We know for a fact that Iraq has been supporting the Palestinian movement. He has transferred a lot of money to the families of martyrs, $25,000 per family. If a killer will blow himself up, he'll pay off the family $25,000. I think that's the only case where they've got a canceled check. The Israelis have that. Do they have any other hard evidence? I think if there were hard evidence, there was a case of Atta meeting with an Iraqi intelligence guy in Czechoslovakia, but that hasn't been proven. It's again, circumstantial evidence, which wouldn't hold up in court.
And I think that's even been questioned lately, that whether or not that meeting actually took
place. That's right. There's some people who say it occurred, and some people say it didn't occur.
Yeah. Well, and I think also some people have questioned or pointed out that maybe Saddam's interests are quite different than those of Osama bin Laden, that, you know, Saddam is very interested in retaining power, that his own personal realm of political power, et cetera, would not, you know, that would be threatened more by Al-Qaeda than actually be aligned with it.
Yeah, they're on completely different trips. And you're right. What this guy is he's the ultimate survivor, is he wants to hang in there. When I look at the big picture and I try to step back from this, is that it seems to me all about that little three-letter word, oil. And why it is beyond my comprehension that we have a country that have incredible resources, extremely bright people, why we can't find an alternate energy supply. We have an oil president. We were able to, in a short period of time, using the resources and high intellect of this land, to develop the atomic bomb. It would seem to me that if we can put people on the moon 40 years ago, we could certainly develop an alternate energy, or we could go like Brazil has and go to ethanol, which would be good for your neck of the woods, because sugar beet and corn and all that stuff grows up around you, right?
You bet.
But why don't we do this? Why are we so beholden to the Middle East if we had an alternate energy, that we didn't need oil, that we were totally independent, then we wouldn't be spending $50 billion a year defending a gas station, which is the Middle East. Every year, that's how much our defense budget goes to keeping the gas station open, that sends gas, a lot of gas to Europe, a lot of gas to Asia, and a fair amount here. If we want to solve the problem, let's solve this problem instead of nobody addresses it. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I have my own thoughts on that, but we can talk about that at more length. But let's take some more calls from listeners.
Okay.
And save me from voicing my own view on that. We'll go next to line number 4, a listener in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
I think the thing is Iraq has nationalized the oil some years ago. And, of course, that could make them evil. Libya also has oil that we don't control. Our big corporations don't control it. And that's, of course, the nuclear and oil business and chemical are all tied in together and are controlling too much of the world. But I think also we've been bombing Iraq since the first Gulf War. And that means that I don't see about every 3 days. I don't see how they got enough money to build a hospital, let alone a nuclear missile. Because even under the economic sanctions, they can trade a little oil for food and medicine. But that's not enough. They won't even sell them a wheelbarrow because it might be used on a nuclear missile, which is kind of far-fetched thinking, I think. But I think that in Saddam would allow inspections in Iraq, but the president doesn't want that. He wants everything just his way. I think he may think that having a war or pretending to have a war even kind of covers up Iran Gate and the business fraud that's been going on in this country. And even he's been involved in that. And as you say, he is an oil president, so he represents oil. Ken Lay helped form our energy policy. We certainly didn't go to renewables. And I think that if we got, you know, we always have a war when things are, economics are bad, the economy is bad. Even Britain did that, had a war with Argentina against the Falkland Islands, and Reagan had a war on Grenada, which is a small country, but it still wrecked their democracy. So war is a way of also making money for the big munitions companies like Boeing and General Dynamics. And
Let me cut in there and see if Colonel Hackworth would like to comment. There's a number of issues that the last caller raised.
Well, I think bottom line is why earlier you said when you're looking at the Pentagon, there's a big cheering section. Let's go do it. And the bottom line is war is good for business. And if you take Cheney, he left from his job as Secretary of Defense and went to Halliburton, and the guy in 1 year made $38 million, and that's a lot of money. And he was a guy that's never really had a job in his life other than work for the government. And he's a very, very wealthy guy. And so there are a whole bunch of folks like that. What I know is war is a racket, and most of the racketeers live in Washington D.C. or they're in the surrounds. And when you look at the weaponry that we're buying and the things that are, just don't work, like the V-22, the Osprey, that does two things well. It's the Marine Corps experimental helicopter. The two things are the crash and burn. And we're spending billions and billions of dollars on these kind of things, and that we don't, in this case, it doesn't work. Or they were built like the F-22 fighter that we're preparing to spend $200 or $300 billion for, was a very excellent fighter designed to do one thing, shoot down the Soviet Union. But wait a minute, didn't they crash 12 years ago? So that's the problem.
Right. Well, we have a couple of the calls to talk with. I want to include as many people as possible. Let me just mention again that we're talking with Colonel David Hackworth. He is a veteran of the military and also a veteran correspondent in wars and conflicts around the world, reported for Newsweek for a number of years, and writes a weekly column that appears around the U.S. And we're talking about issues with regard to possible war with Iraq, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Chicago, I believe, on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
David, Colonel Hackworth, I've been an admirer of yours for quite a while. I saw you on the History Channel when you were talking about your experiences in Korea over the Century show. And I also got a kick out of when you talked about when you're in Vietnam and your Thanksgiving, where the general wanted to talk to all you guys and ruined your dinner. But anyway, nevertheless, if we have a war with Iraq, do you think it will last as long as the first one did?
Good question. I think based on the condition of the Iraqi army, which is it's probably 80% of the capability down of the capability that it had during Desert Storm 1. It, as one of your callers said, they have didn't have the money to buy spare parts. The army's kind of kept together with green tape and baling wire and chewing gum. So militarily, with the force that's out there to hit them, that this fist that we've been putting in place since last November, and I'm not giving away military secrets, Saddam Hussein has stevedores on every dock, he has people in every airport, he's counting the boxes of beans and bullets and soldiers and tanks and all that stuff that are unloading. So there's this huge fist that's going to come at him. He saw it come at him again, but he doesn't have the kind of force to stop it. So he knows his history. Now he's talking about now, it was in the front lines, the front pages of Washington Post and the New York Times today, that his strategy is going to be to hole up into the cities and not fight us as he tried to before in the open desert, where he would just be clobbered. and he's going to try to do as the Russians did at Stalingrad.
Mm-hmm.
And so bottom line is, will that strategy work? And my view of it is, if I were fighting Saddam Hussein, if I were his American counterpart general, and as I say, he's the master of miscalculation. He's never got it right on any battlefield. And the only way he even came to a Mexican standoff with Iran was using weapons of mass destruction. I would be so thrilled that he was putting himself in jail, just as the Afghani tribal leaders who were fighting in the 10th century tactics recently built these great fortresses and thought they could hide behind all this air power. So it would be ideal if he puts his military around Baghdad and other big towns and dug them in, because what we need to do then is simply surround the town. There would be any bloodshed, shut off the electricity, shut off the water, and within about 10 days, the rats would leave the ship. And that would be the end of the guy, and it would be done kind of painlessly.
Well, you know, I'm wondering also why we didn't do something about Libya. You know, they committed an act of war against us when they blew up that airliner. And I've always wondered why we didn't deal with that problem.
Well, I guess, and that's beyond my expertise, who is responsible for what. Reagan sure hit him hard over the one little hand grenade that was thrown in a bar in Berlin, if you'll recall that.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And but I think that's another subject. I think militarily, we would be able to, I'll just stick with that for 1 minute,
mm-hmm.
we'd be able to take out the Iraqi army, probably, to answer your question, as quick or quicker as we did during Desert Storm. I think you'd see a massive air campaign that might last a couple months, and with that you'd see a lot of new weapons that have never been employed on a battlefield before that would put the Iraqi military out of business, just quick, smart. And then you'd have the capitulation, the white flags that you saw during Desert Storm. But the risk is really high in that Saddam Hussein knows this time that he will not be let up at the last moment. He knows that if the president goes after him, it's history. It's not like his dad going after him. And as a result, he'll probably, based on this psychotic personality that I have studied, he'll probably try to do as much damage to Israel and to America as possible. Our soldiers in the field are going to be well protected with fine masks that will protect them from weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological, with the proper suits that will protect them, and with good detection equipment. So the risk is really high, but I think that we will probably not have the kind of casualties that was envisioned for Desert Storm, which was 2,000 dead and ended up with 162 dead. The Israelis are protected, meaning they have, every citizen has a gas mask, every home by ordinance has a sealed room, so does every office that you can go to, and you're protected from chemical and biological. The first responders, firemen, policemen, medics, have all been vaccinated or are being vaccinated for smallpox and anthrax and so on. And they're about to issue an anti-radiation pill to every citizen. So there's a country that knows it's going to get it and is prepared. Now, it is my judgment that in our country, Saddam Hussein has already brought in weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological. They're here under the care of his sleepers, waiting to be activated. And I make this judgment for one, he has fanatics around him that will go down with him and would execute this kind of a kamikaze mission. Is it easy to bring this stuff into the country? Absolutely. Tons of heroin and cocaine come into this country every year. We can't stop that. There's 6 million containers come into this country each year from overseas, but 2% of those are inspected, so it would be easy to bring in barrels of smallpox and anthrax and Ebola and whatever you wanted to give to these sleepers to distribute. So what I think the president should do is really say, are my people protected as well as the Israelis or my soldiers in the field? Why haven't I stood tall? Why haven't the 500,000 first responders been vaccinated for smallpox? Why haven't we taken the proper precautions to alert and inform the American people how they can protect themselves and of the danger? Then when you say, well, wait a minute, maybe this is just some hysterical guy making this up. Do you remember what happened to a guy named Padilla in Chicago a few weeks ago? Padilla being a guy, an American, that was trained in Afghanistan by Osama bin Laden's gang to make a dirty bomb, bomb here. And now he was scarfed up and he's apparently talking his head out. He came here with a mission of making a dirty nuke bomb. Now, about 2 weeks ago, a shipment of radioactive material slipped across the Canadian border. We picked it up after it arrived, and nobody knows where it is, and the FBI and everybody else is looking frantically for it. But, hey, this is the mixing of the key component of making a dirty bomb. So you got to say that I make the assumption that this opponent, Saddam Hussein, is going to try to create as much damage as he can, and that he has people here capable of doing this, and he has the bad stuff here that's capable of doing it, and we're not prepared. So if you were the president, Jack, I'd say, hey, why don't we get squared away at home first?
Well, there's the question, isn't it? I mean, it seems that what we have is the building of a massive bureaucracy, the Department of Homeland Security, and a new color code to advise us the risk level, but really not a whole lot, as far as the public can see, not a whole lot else.
No, but we've spent millions and perhaps billions of dollars building the slickest, one of the biggest bureaucracies known to Washington, D.C., which invented the word. And I tend to totally agree with you. Homeland Security is a joke, and this politician that's running it, a good friend of the president, Governor Ridge, is a guy that's great at patting people on the back and shaking hands, but in 10 months, Homeland Security hasn't done zilch. And I've just finished a book tour, and on the book tour I visited 42 cities around America, and I went through 31 airports, and I only found two that passed this old colonel's inspection. The rest were as bad as they were before 911.
We have several calls to talk with. Let me just mention again, we're a little past our midpoint here with Colonel David Hackworth, military veteran and veteran commentator on matters pertaining to the military. And we're talking about possible repercussions of war with Iraq. And your questions are welcome. We have actually most of our lines are full. One line open. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another Urbana listener on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Are you seriously proposing that we are going to bomb, 50% of the world's most precious archaeological sites? That country is you can practically walk across archaeological sites. That is the homeland of civilization. And you're going to blast it the way we did Afghanistan?
Well, I think we kind of did that about 10 years ago. I don't know.
Not the way they're talking about doing it now. We didn't flatten Baghdad. And if we do, what is the reaction going to be in the masses in Egypt, North Africa?
Interesting question.
South Asia.
Well, no one has seen the war plans except the New York Times, who printed them, and which they gleefully said these are highly, highly classified plans, which just blew me apart, because bottom line is you're putting American soldiers and sailors who are instruments of the policy at great risk. But the plan, I believe, from what all I can see, wouldn't envision bombing built-up areas as we did in Germany and Dresden, Berlin, Tokyo, where millions of people perished. I think the simple solution, if I were running things, would be just put a cordon around the city and shut the lights and electricity off, and that would be the end of Baghdad. It's a city that gets all its water from upstream and all its power from about a couple plants about 50 miles north of the city, so it'd be easy to do that.
Great. And let's say that Saddam has 2,000 fanatical backers. All they have to do is slip back to their families and wait.
Yeah, I think I'm hoping, I kind of got the view that I'm being looked upon as somebody that's advocating the military solution. Are you suggesting that?
No, you sound much too sane for that. And my initial question was
But you're right.
Yeah.
I think that there's, from what I've read about Iraq, there's so much dissent among the people, the average Joe on the street, that few people then would be eliminated. I can recall during Desert Storm when the president made the terribly bad call, the Iraqi army was destroyed. What I noticed all over the land was the, especially in the south, with the Shiites, they were overthrowing the local Gestapo, the local police, the local mayors, and even up north, close to Baghdad itself, they hanged a couple of Saddam Hussein's guys, and we had encouraged that revolution, kind of like with Czechoslovakia or Hungary, and then we let all these folks who came out of their holes and They almost toppled his government, and that was the people. So I think the people are far more angry now.
But
I don't think he would have the support of the people and these few hoodlums that are keeping him in power, the so-called Republican Guard and so on. I think that they would be pretty badly stoned.
I have a feeling that they're even more angry with us.
I don't know. I haven't been to Iraq in a while. When was the last time you were there?
Well, I've never been there, but I have an Iranian wife.
Uh-huh.
I know the Middle East. And I think when you attack any of those countries, they will rally around.
Well, you're right. And I have to say that from my experience, Saddam Hussein to many, many Arabs around the world is Robin Hood.
That's right.
But not with very many Iranians, I have to tell you that.
Well, there's a long-standing dispute between Iran and Iraq, yes, and Iran and the Arabs. But, I see an awful lot of downside. I can see it degenerating into, this is was a modern nation, but a modern nation that was also a tribal nation. It's still tribal, and I can see civil war so that we... I'm not sure the Army's wrong when they say they need 200,000 men. And I'm not sure they don't really need to put that kind of number into Afghanistan. I don't see how we've won the war there. It appears to me that every time the Afghanis have the chance, they're going to attack us.
Well, the problem in Iraq is that you have very different ethnic people, the Kurds and the Shiites and so on. And the thing about keeping that country together as one entity at the end of the war is the thing that has some smart people like Colin Powell and Kissinger and so on very, very concerned. On Iraq, Afghanistan, my take on the thing is we should get out of there with our ground folks. Yes, we should encourage and live up to our obligation in terms of nation build and provide support and so on, but our folks on the ground are just moving targets, and we've had 40 dead, almost 400 wounded, and most Americans don't know this, and we're involved in a war where things are so unstable in that country that the president of the country, our installed puppet, can't even depend upon his own people to secure him. He's being secured by American special forces. And the only place that's halfway secured in the whole country is around the capital, and that's where most of the peacekeeping efforts, the international peacekeeping efforts are, and the Americans are out in the bush hunting without very much success. But every day or so, we end up taking a casualty. It would seem to me that the best thing for America to do would be to provide logistical support, nation-building support, intelligence, aircraft, but get our guys off out of the ground that are moving about with a huge target behind them. And don't go repeat the lessons of Vietnam, which was don't get involved in somebody else's civil war in Afghanistan, because this is not a simple two-way civil war as Vietnam was between the North and the South. This is a civil war with increasingly more powerful warlords, and there are a whole bunch of them.
It's very interesting. It seems that I wonder if we're falling to the same sort of thinking that we can use the military to impose democracy. Do you think there's a danger of trying to view Iraq as a sort of a place where we can do that? We see a bad guy in charge, and we're going to use the military to take him out, and somehow expect, you know, a democratic government to happen sort of in his place.
Well, I think there are thinkers that look upon after Saddam Hussein, there would be a long U.S. military occupation, not unlike Germany and Japan and the Philippines and so on after World War II, and we should shy away from that.
We have, we have
never done a really good job in nation building.
Sort of asking the military to do nation building is the wrong mission.
That's right. They're not. It's the wrong job for those folks.
Well, our lines are almost full. Let's go on and talk with some more callers, and we'll go next to someone in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, good morning. A couple comments, then a couple questions. Aside from the money to be made by having a war in Iraq and keeping our minds off the Enron presidency during the elections, I think if you're rich or you're constantly fighting insecurity and you want to be able to think that your soldiers have seen real action, so there's a real impetus to try to get them out there and get them, you know, actually battle tested. And then there's our munitions. If they're new, they need to be tested, like you mentioned. But if they're old, they have a shelf life and they need to be replenished. But my questions are, what do you think of the kind of remote view of war making that's being depicted by some movies recently? Is it really very effective? And two, what of Russia's support for Iraq? Do you think it could extend to military support? Is it really something worth thinking about?
Well, I think Russia's military is pretty busted up, and Russia's living on U.S. food stamps. So I think that if they had to choose between the USA and our food stamps and all of the rest of the Horn of Plenty and Iraq, who owes them $7 billion, and they do a lot of business with them, they would choose us. So the fact that they've recently allowed us to use their bases all over the world, their former bases, and we're using them now in Georgia in preparation for Iraq, former Soviet fighter bases, I wouldn't give that a big worry.
How about the remote viewing thing? Is, you know, where you have these sometimes satellites, sometimes unmanned planes taking photographs of where the action is. Is that really very effective, or is it all kind of hype?
No, it's extremely effective, incredibly effective. But it has a great downside to it, too. Here you have in Afghanistan, on the battlefield, but you flash away almost 9,000 miles to Tampa, Florida, and you've got the general running the war. And you've got the same firefight being displayed not only in Tampa but in the White House, in the Pentagon, and in all kinds of headquarters. For example, the Third Army headquarters that was in Kuwait, that was controlling our forces in Afghanistan, was giving direction and micromanagement kind of direction to the guys in Afghanistan, as was the general running things in Tampa, as was all the generals and admirals who just couldn't keep themselves out of the little firefight when the fight really needed a major or a lieutenant colonel to run it, not all of this high-powered people. So there's the downside. You've got too many cooks making the broth, and they're bound to screw it up. So on the upside, it provides instantaneous intelligence that you'll never. One of the big killers of war is a thing called the fog of war. The commander never really knows what's over that hill, what's down in that valley, what his enemy is planning to do. But this thing kind of cuts that fog away.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We have just about 8 minutes left with Colonel David Hackworth and a couple callers. We'll get them both in, and we'll go next to someone in Whiteheath on line number one. Good morning.
Hello. This is something you mentioned earlier on in the conversation about why we haven't gone to renewable resources, and then we wouldn't be so beholden to the Middle East and their oil. But if we do that, what's going to happen with Israel? Will we turn our backs on them then, finally, or what, if we get out of that area and not depend on the Middle East for oil?
Oh, it's a good question. Again, my expertise is the military, Israel. I would think that we would probably never abandon Israel. I think that we're kind of joined together at the hip. And if we did come up with an alternate energy, I think that we would always be supportive of Israel. And I think down the line, it seems to me what's going to occur in Israel is that they're going to know that there's two things that can kill them. One is an enemy from without, and one is the population growth from within, because the Muslims propagated about 8-1 to the Israelis. So eventually what's going to happen to Israel if they don't change how they run things, it's going to be the same thing that happened to Kosovo. In 1900 in Kosovo, there were Christian to Muslim ratio was 93% Christian and 7% Muslim. But when the country fell and became a separate entity from Yugoslavia, it had reversed exactly to 93% Muslim and 7% Christian. And so I think a lot of Israelis recognize this, and this and the thinking is going to be what the Israelis are going to do is recognizing they'll probably never be able to get along with this hatred. It's like kind of like the Hatfields and McCoys, that they're going to end up kind of cleaning out the Arab population from Israel and building a huge wall, and then using all their brains and their Silicon Valley of technology and so on, which little country of Israel, I think it's 4 million people as opposed to over 100 million Arabs, it outproduces them like 300% in GMP and so on. So I think that's what they're going to finally end up doing. And, of course, they'll probably be shipping a lot of their brains and a lot of their stuff our way.
Oh, okay. Thank you for the analysis.
Okay, thanks for the call. We've got about 5 minutes left. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign County on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you say, and then you say something like what you just said, which is basically blessing ethnic cleansing.
I'm not saying I endorse it, but what happened with Greece when they had great problems with the Turks and so on, that's exactly what they did in the 20s and 30s, and it worked.
Well, and we were helping out on that too, actually, with the Truman Doctrine. But I wanted to actually.
I was talking about 20s and 30s. You know, Truman was a Boy Scout then.
Okay. Well, we did help. We did help later, and the generals were actually involved in the Cyprus situation. Maybe I was thinking of that. You mentioned the Mexican standoff between Iran and Iraq. It was true that the U.S. Contributed intelligence to the Iraqi side, and the vaunted trip of Simpson and Dole and the doling out the tax credits. There's actually the argument made that the gassing of the Halabja area, which was supposedly to protect a dam, would decimated the wheat-producing region, and that's why the U.S. came in with its credits for purchasing wheat. So we were basically helping all along, and in fact, the Iraqis fought to this standoff, as you called it, it even took direct intervention. I mean, the U.S. was interdicting Iranian boats in the Persian Gulf. I mean, we were basically, and now they have this he gasses his own people. Well, we underwrote it. And I would like to know, some of that's from Scott Ritter and reminding me of the analysis, and some of it's from Chomsky. But Ritter was totally felt betrayed. I don't agree with everything that Ritter says either. He voted for Bush, after all, and thinks that he can be talked to, which I think is not a likely scenario. But he was betrayed because he thought he was on a UN fact-finding mission, and he was on a Butler, your friend, apparently. Have you asked him directly if he was knowingly, or he doesn't mind being duped by the U.S. intelligence forces?
Well, I'm sure that as all operations that we conduct overseas, at Peace Corps and so on, there's a fair number of CIA folks working there. That's the nature of the beast.
Well, supposedly a UN...
In warfare,
right.
In warfare, the most important instrument is not the cannon, it's not how much gunpowder you got stored up, but it's the spy.
It's intelligence.
Yeah, it's
military intelligence is said to be a contradiction in terms, too. You're demonstrating that's not entirely true. But
well, thank you.
Yeah. Well,
listen, it's great talking to you, and my website is hackworth.com. And if you want to read about my new book, Steal My Soldier's Heart, there's info there. And the bottom line is I wrote it to salute those poor kids that fought in Vietnam, that came home. They were draftees, and they came home and they were spit upon because the American people thought they were the ones that were guilty rather than the presidents and the generals and all the people that we've been attacking here. And it is... still with their lessons learned, it's in their voice, and the lessons learned are so applicable. If we would just apply them in all of these battlefields where our soldiers are involved now, and when I look at the world right today, I can't recall a time that we've had more soldiers in combat condition around the globe other than World War II than we have now. And I'm talking not just the Philippines and not just Iraq, in Afghanistan, but in dozens of countries around the world, as I speak, there are American soldiers hunting and being hunted by someone in this war of terrorism. And we need to learn from the past. So that in Steal My Soldier's Heart, I record these lessons that in the voices of these young kids that are now in their mid-50s who are noble, brave, heroic, fighting a very, very bad war, that were badly treated by the citizens of this country, and they have yet to be welcomed home. And I think we need to understand that, and we need to welcome home and tell these kids that stood so tall and answered their country's call, and they were mostly draftees, welcome home and thank you.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned your new book because I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to read it, but it's certainly something I wanted to make people aware of, and they can get more information about it on your website as well.
Yep.
And that is www.hackworth.com. And I'm sorry to say that we're here at the end of our time. There's much more we could talk about, and perhaps we can do so at a later date.